And we are rolling. Hi, Alex.
Hi there, Mark. How are you?
Good. So this is Mark Goldberg with UN Dispatch, speaking with...
Alex Massey from The Spectator.
And Alex, we are speaking 1 week after, rather surprisingly, the Parliament, your Parliament, or maybe not yours because you're Scottish, but the British Parliament... you voted down the war resolution. Just sort of explain what happened.
David Cameron's greatest humiliation as Prime Minister. At least that was the instant verdict of the London newspapers. What happened was that Parliament has been on recess on its summer holidays recently, but with the situation in Syria becoming extra critical after 2 years of butchery and slaughter and 100,000 deaths, something had to be done. The use of chemical weapons, or the apparent use of chemical weapons, mandated that Western powers should consider intervening at some point and slap Bashar al-Assad on the wrist or put him into detention for a short period of time. As a result of which, David Cameron took the decision to recall Parliament for a debate and discussion as to whether Britain should be involved in any putative Western military intervention in Syria. The Prime Minister rather bungled this because, for a number of reasons, which we can get into if you like, he misjudged the mood of his party. He misjudged the mood of the country as a whole. He was also, I think it's plausible to say, betrayed by Ed Miliband, the leader of the Labour Party, who had initially suggested that Labour would be on board with a broad resolution that essentially suggested that something should be done. We're not quite sure exactly what that something should be or when it should be done, but something should be done.
Was that on Ed Miliband? Was that, do you think, an intentional attempt to score some points against the Prime Minister?
I think it was to some extent, but I think it was also... accidental. I mean, what happened was that Labour sought all sorts of assurances from Cameron that any strike would be limited, that there would that it would be legal, that it would be based on a published intelligence assessment that Assad's regime was responsible for the chemical weapons attacks that we've seen in Syria, and that the United Kingdom would return to the United Nations and do its best to get a resolution passed at the Security Council there. Cameron conceded on all of these issues, and I think legitimately expected Labour to support a resolution that had no particular power to it. It didn't commit the United Kingdom to doing anything. And so then I think the Conservative leadership was very surprised when Labour decided they would vote against a resolution that in large part they had written themselves. This plus a Tory backbench rebellion and a number of defections from Cameron's coalition partners, the Liberal Democrats, resulted in a 13-vote defeat for the government position, with the result that Britain will not take part in any military action against Syria. I get that was Cameron's response to the setback. The irony of it is that there was a majority probably in the House that favoured, let's wait and see what happens. Let's not commit to anything right now. Labour put forward an amendment that was substantially the same as the government's own position. And all the Conservative MPs who'd voted in favour of the government's position voted against Labour's amendment, and vice versa. Labour MPs who'd opposed the government's position voted for their amendment, which basically did much the same thing. So, I mean, Parliament has ended up, it was hailed as a great day for Parliament, holding the executive to account. But actually, Parliament's ended up with no policy at all. Britain is now on the sidelines, whether this is a good thing or not. It's ended up there by accident. Most people didn't want to rule out action. I mean, Miliband himself said, I'm not with those who rule out action, but then committed himself to a position that has ended up ruling Britain out. Shambles, a cock-up, really.
If that sort of Labour amendment that you described, to the extent that it mandated that the UK, get Security Council approval before launching a military strike, if that wasn't just a poison pill, knowing full well that Security Council approval wasn't coming anytime soon.
I think you would hope that they would have the wit to realize, to make it a poison pill. If they didn't, better for it to be a poison
pill. An accidental poison pill.
Than for them to be so naive as to think that a Security Council resolution might be coming. Or to put it another way, to allow the Russians and the Chinese to dictate British foreign policy, which is a curious form of leadership. Separate from whether intervention in Syria is a wise thing to do or not, if it is to be done or if it is not to be done, it should probably be decided by, London, Paris and Washington, not by Moscow or Beijing. But Labour essentially have ended up in a position where they don't have a policy. Today, there were all sorts of Labour MPs in Parliament at Prime Minister's Question sort of queuing up to suggest that, well, we need to engage with Iran to sort out Syria, which, it might be a nice idea, but it doesn't seem like a terribly practical approach to take. What next? New ponies for every small girl in Syria.
Right. Well, I think that speaks to the point, Labour not having a policy perhaps speaks to a point that there is no real good policy to have right now.
I think that's true, isn't it? That nobody actually wants to do. Everybody feels that something ought to be done, but nobody actually really wants to do anything because there are no attractive options. In that sense, Parliament ended up, being quite close to public opinion. Public opinion in Britain is markedly less interventionist on the Syrian question than opinion in either France or Germany is. And there are all sorts of reasons for that. Everybody last week was saying, this isn't Iraq. Syria is not Iraq. And then, but it was impossible to discuss Syria without the shadow of Iraq, even though, quite obviously, the terms of engagement and objectives are very different. It didn't help that Tony Blair started popping up all over the place, writing articles for various newspapers saying that intervention was a necessary thing. Blair rather dented, I think, and damaged the interventionist cause by reminding people of past misadventures.
What's so interesting about that is that, I think these comparisons to Iraq are inevitable. If you're looking at sort of British policy's effect on sort of American politics, which is readily apparent right now, given Obama's decision last weekend to suspend temporarily his march to war and do the same thing that David Cameron did, which is ask for Congress's approval. What was interesting, looking back to 2002, 2003, was the role that Tony Blair played here in the United States. I think he played a key role in convincing American liberals to go along with Bush's war plan. I mean, we liberals had this just immense distrust of George Bush for a variety of reasons. But I think, American liberals appreciated Tony Blair, well-spoken, charming, friend of Bill Clinton, he still had, I think, that aura about him. Mm-hmm. And his very articulate, at least compared to George Bush's explanation for war, I think really did help push American liberals to, by and large, support the war. I did not. I'll wave that flag. But that sort of a dynamic is sort of
He was the respectable. He was the respectable face of let's get involved in Iraq. Whatever doubts you had about Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney, Blair was on site, and to a lesser extent, Colin Powell, I think, was another reassuring voice for some people anyway. Absolutely. One question I wanted to ask you about, though, Mark, was, do you think Obama would, does Obama want congressional approval or not, essentially?
It seems like it would be a good out, right? It would, obviously he's backed himself into a corner. You get the impression, based on a lot of what I get the impression that he's struggling against two, I think, competing imperatives. The first is, I think he does have a deep-seated appreciation for the importance of international law in sort of global affairs and maintaining you know, war and peace and global security. But you have these two competing sort of elements of international law that are going sort of head on right now. The first is the longstanding prohibition against chemical weapons, which, you know, I get the impression that he's, you know, he takes that very, very seriously. And, you know, which, and this prohibition has not been sort of, has only very rarely been violated. That's sort of one sort of imperative of international law. The other is this question of who gets to authorize international interventions, and that's the Security Council. It's really unambiguous. Unless there's an incident of self-defense, it is exclusively the Security Council that holds the right to authorize an international intervention. He got that intervention in Libya. He got that resolution, that authorization in Libya. That's not forthcoming in Syria. So you have these, I think, two real competing imperatives that he's sort of weighing in his head. And I think until last week's British vote, he was willing to let the chemical weapons side of the ledger dictate his actions. Now I get the impression that he's willing to sort of that he's trying to sort of get out and to get back to your original question of whether or not he actually wants Congress to approve this. I think the answer is very much yes. I mean, if you look at yesterday, the testimony between the testimony of John Kerry and of Martin Dempsey and of Chuck Hagel, it was really strong. I mean, it was not, it was very, very forceful, very strong. And if you saw the public statements, I mean, all of congressional leadership is lining up behind this. So I think he does very much want to get this passed, even though it would be, I think, a convenient and, in my opinion, an acceptable out at this point.
Yeah. I mean, Kerry was talking about, you know, raising, I mean, this very much was like, 2002, 2003, the specter of Munich, was raised, as is always the case with these things. And, you know, fairly fanciful a decade ago, in relation to Iraq, strikes me as being utterly inappropriate and stupid in relation to Syrian civil war. I see what you I take your point, obviously, about the prohibition on chemical weapons and so on is something serious. I mean, once that red line, is crossed once, it becomes easier to cross again, and it becomes easier for other countries to cross that line too. But at the same time, there is something distasteful, isn't there, about a war that is designed a war is putting it too strongly, military action that is designed to send the message that you are sending a message and nothing more than that.
Right. I mean, it's sort of warfare for sort of symbolism's sake, not for achieving any sort of actual sort of, you know, change on the ground. Although what you're seeing, interestingly, in the sort of the sort of new messaging we're hearing yesterday and today from the Obama administration is that, and I think this is intended to win over sort of that John McCain, Lindsey Graham, neocon wing of the party, is that they're sort of suggesting that, yes, these will be limited strikes, but they will have long-lasting impacts in terms of degrading Assad's, ability to carry out his attack. So they're trying to sort of walk this fine line between wanting to assure the neocons that these are going to be forceful attacks that will perhaps tip the balance of the war, versus assuring the more skeptical liberal wing of the party that these are very limited attacks that will not escalate into anything more than the simple act of punishing Assad for using chemical weapons.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very difficult balance to strike, isn't it? On the one hand, nobody wants to see Assad win this war. But at the same time, nobody's really sure, I think, that they want the rebels to win either. From if you want to look at it from a sort of ice-cold realpolitik perspective and so on, you could argue that it is essentially in U.S. interests for the Civil War to continue for as long as possible, in a sort of, and the bloodier the stalemate, the better.
See, I've heard that argument.
That's very callous, I actually disagree with that view of things, but I think you can make that argument, can't you?
I know, but I think even from a realpolitik perspective, that fails to acknowledge the destabilizing effect that this war is having on the entire region.
Mm.
The spillover of the fighting in Lebanon, the sort of massive influx of refugees into Jordan, which mm-hmm. is struggling with its own sort of economic, a very tenuous sort of economic and social challenges right now. In Iraq, I think you're seeing sort of this sort of increasing sectarian violence, perhaps linked to the conflict in Syria. So I think region, if you're looking at this from a strictly realpolitik perspective, then in fact, letting two enemies battle it out is still not good for American or global interests.
No, I mean, I'd agree with that. It's bad, but it is, without getting too Rumsfeldian about it, it is a known bad. In a way that either of the either side winning introduces fresh uncertainties and fresh difficulties. You're absolutely right about potential spillover effects into other countries. But you know, in a game with no good outcomes, maintaining the status quo is, from one perspective, I mean, it's not an idealistic or moral or particularly attractive perspective, but it is, I think you can argue mm-hmm. that it is the least bad or the least troublesome of all the very bad, very troublesome possibilities, permutations, options, and so on.
If I could just sort of see your Rumsfeld and raise you one, the known unknown. is again that explosion across the region, and mm-hmm. how that plays out as this conflict like grinds on is tough. And that's actually one place where I feel like, just switching to the UN, where the UN, because of the paralysis at the Security Council, will probably get knocked in some circles for being useless. But it's I think important and crucial to point out that sort of the one entity that is sort of taking care of these refugees, that is trying to mitigate the region-wide consequence and fallout from this crisis, are sort of UN humanitarian agencies, which are mm-hmm. totally underfunded, which are overworked and under-resourced to carry out this massive humanitarian operation that they are. They're doing in places like Jordan and Lebanon and Syria. In Syria and in Turkey as well.
Absolutely. I mean, how much money does the U.S. owe the U.N. at the moment?
It
did pay up some of it, didn't it?
So the U.S. is all caught up in its arrears to the regular U.N. budget.
Yeah.
But the way in which these humanitarian operations are funded is entirely through voluntary contributions. So member states pay into the U.N. every year based on a formula that's calculated as a percentage of their gross national product.
Uh-huh.
So the U.S. pays like 25% of the U.N.'s regular budget and 28% mm-hmm. of the U.N. peacekeeping budget. But mm-hmm. programs like the World Food Program, UNICEF, the U.N. Refugee Agency, the U.N. Population Fund are all entirely funded as if they were a charity.
Yeah.
That countries just pay into it what they want when they want. So when you have these huge emergencies like Syria, that accelerate, as it is now, then these agencies are caught totally under-resourced. And there's no like real large standing pool of money that can bail these countries out. It's almost always done
on
an ad hoc basis. And that actually negatively affects other crises around the world, like South Sudan or Darfur. Because money is moved from one crisis to another.
I was just going to ask, you obviously, spent a lot of time analyzing the UN and all its workings. How does this play out for the UN in terms of everybody assumes that the Russians in particular are going to stymie any Security Council resolution? Is that the correct assumption in the first place? And secondly, assuming that if it is correct, how does that then play out in terms of what Washington does, how the UN operates in, after this, what will be the impact of this on the UN and indeed on US relations with the UN?
So I think in
there's quite sort of several questions there, of course, but yeah.
So the first, I think the first point is that the UN is right now in a pretty no-win situation.
Yeah.
Where, you know, the UN charter is very, as I said, unambiguous that only the Security Council gets to grant, intervention, gets to grant military intervention, gets to say, that you can bomb this country because they violated the chemical weapons protocol. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you know, again, there's this longstanding principle of against the sort of use of chemical weapons that's been violated that needs to be upheld in some way. And so either way, I think the UN lose. Either you diminish the principle that chemical weapons use ought to be deterred in the future, or you diminish the idea that the Security Council is the sole legal authority that can authorize the use of force. It's a very tough sort of position for, you know, those of us who believe in sort of international legal norms, international law, mm-hmm. and all that good stuff.
Is ignored, mm-hmm. if you like, or flouted in this instance. And it's a question then of picking which one.
Yeah, but in terms of sort of the actual operations of the UN, let's assume that the U.S. violates the Security Council, violates the UN Charter, and bombs Syria. I think it is fair to assume that once the dust settles, after intervention, after the sort of, you know, whatever conflict plays itself out, eventually in Syria, when it comes to a conclusion, that the UN will probably have a very large role to play in mm-hmm. Syria. I mean, we saw this, even though the Security Council is so hopelessly divided, I mean, we saw this principally in Kosovo. NATO and the U.S. launched a bombing campaign over Serbia and the Balkans, despite Security Council not authorizing it. But the day after the bombs, the day after Milosevic and the day after the bombs stopped, the UN launched a massive massive peacekeeping operation that was approved by the Security Council. Mm. Similarly in Iraq, the Security Council was hopelessly divided right before the intervention. After the intervention, after Saddam fell, the Security Council unanimously authorized a very robust political operation. And the UN sent in their best and brightest people, including the late Sergio Vieira de Mello, who was mm-hmm. killed in that Iraq attack. So there is, I think, that precedent that even though the act of going to war is disputed at the Security Council, the proper role of the U.S. of the United Nations to clean up the mess, I think, is still sort of unchanged. So I think eventually we can assume sort of a broad UN role.
Yeah. I mean, in that sense, the UN retains the both the will and the desire and the capacity to act. One of the things I think that's been quite clear over the last few days in Britain, and I think one sees this in the United States as well, where there's sort of misgivings and ambivalence about the wisdom and purpose of intervention is so much greater now than it was, you know, even with the limited Libyan campaign, which admittedly had slightly clearer goals and objectives than the Syrian intervention looks like having. But one of the things we see in the UK is essentially a tiredness, that it has been a full decade, more than a decade, actually, if you include Afghanistan, of interventions of one sort or another. And people have just had enough. There is a feeling that it is not our problem anymore. Or if it is our problem, we don't actually know how to solve it. In one sense, you could term this a sort of newfound modesty, but it's also a sort of fatalistic view of international affairs, and it has Britain in particular, I think, questioning quite once again what its role in the world is. if Britain isn't going to be one of those countries that that enforces things like the long-standing prohibition on the use of chemical weapons, then what sort of country are we now? And what sort of, you know, who is going to enforce those norms? And so I think that you know, that's one of the things that we've seen in Britain recently, and it is again, a sort of fatigue after more than a decade of foreign entanglements. I get the sense that feeling is more widespread in the United States now than it was, and you see that in the sort of qualified and hesitant nature of much of the debate about Syria. At least that's my sense viewed from this side of the Atlantic.
Yes, and I think what's sort of been most interesting to see is that you see that mostly right now on the Republican side. There's an entire wing of the Republican Party now that is, I think, like you said, sort of war weary, that is pushing against this, that sort of is very much fighting against this neocon wing of the party, you know, the Tea Party folk.
Yeah, I think, it's a by and large. Rand Paul versus
versus McCain. Yeah, exactly. I mean, and so you see that, and you see that reflected in also sort of opinion polls about sort of whether or not the U.S. should get involved in Syria. It's sort of very there's sort of very little and limited support for American intervention right now. But I wanted to, so you said something interesting about how there's a sort of soul searching about how the UK sort of sees its role in the world. I mean, it used to be that or not that long ago, that the UK would sort of, you know, be America's greatest ally in Europe. And that was sort of its role in the world, to bridge that gap, to join the US. So how might, you know, this vote affect, one, that the transatlantic relationship, or two, even Britain's relationship with the rest of Europe?
I think that there were these sort of, you know, immediate pronouncements of, the special relationship, which is such a tedious and ghastly phrase and indeed in some ways concept too, is now dead. It is like the parrot in Monty Python sketch. It is an ex-relationship. The United States has fallen in love with its oldest allies, the perfidious French, again. All of that is an exaggeration, quite a severe exaggeration as well, I think. Most of the bedrock of the Anglo-American relationship will continue, because it lies in intelligence sharing and that sort of thing, and indeed in culture. So that, you know, if you like, there you've got one official strand to it, and one sort of unofficial and public, and both of those will endure. I think domestically, you will see Ed Miliband posturing at the next election that he was the man enough to stand up to the Americans and tell them that they were wrong about Syria. And he was man enough to stand up to Rupert Murdoch and tell him that he was wrong about all sorts of things that he was doing with his newspapers in the UK. But I think, you know, actually, I would be surprised if long term, once this is over with, there will be that much damage done. One thing that is certain, however, is that I think it will be very, very difficult for prime ministers in the future to send British troops or planes or ships into military action without a vote of Parliament authorising it. Cameron actually has no need to seek that sort of approval. I mean, he can just do it. Just as Blair sought parliamentary approval for Iraq, and that's something that people have sometimes forgotten about, that Parliament actually approved the invasion of Iraq as well. So that set a precedent. Now, of course, in the British system, most of the time you're not going to have any difficulties carrying that, because most of the time, you know, you have governments with a secure majority, and they can impose a three-line whip, and they can organise the vote rather more effectively than the Tories did last week. I mean, the government should have won its vote last week. I mean, it mishandled it appallingly. There were various MPs who weren't present because they were at weddings, There were a couple of MPs who somehow or other managed to be in the chamber but failed to vote. There was a lot of dithering and confusion, and it was handled extremely badly. Cameron's the Whip's office did very little to actually persuade MPs that, you know, the government was in danger of losing this vote, and so, you know, they needed to get on board. Cameron's relations with Tory backbenchers have always been cool and distant, and some of them actually have just got to the point where they quite like they quite enjoy kicking the Prime Minister. And if that is something to be done over Syria, then so be it. I think long term, there won't be that much of an impact on Anglo-American relations. And in terms of relations with the rest of Europe, Britain wants to be part of Europe, but on its own terms, and it wants to be part of the English-speaking world as well. London is a place where East meets West now in terms of the global economy. London has become, the sort of great metropolis, by some distance, Europe's greatest metropolis, a melting pot on a scale of 19th century New York in many ways. I think Britain wants to have the best of both worlds still. And that often means not quite having the best of either. I think it still sees itself as a bridge between Washington and Brussels. It's not how it's seen in other parts of Europe, of course, but that I think is still how the British see themselves, at least at the elite level. There is a lot of latent grumbling about these things amongst the people, but the special relationship is much cherished by political and media elites in Britain, who spend an awful lot of time fretting about it. a ridiculous amount of time analysing it, because it is fundamentally, however, based on shared interests. And so long as those interests remain broadly similar, there's no real reason to suppose that the Anglo-American alliance is suddenly going to wither away.
Maybe my last question is more about maybe British domestic politics. But how weakened was Cameron by this vote to pursue some of his other domestic political agenda?
He was weakened, certainly. But then he began in a position of some weakness as well. It is a long time since the Conservatives had a lead in any opinion poll. Most opinion polls put Labour between 4 and 10 points ahead, and that hasn't really changed very much for months. I mean, there's been some movement back towards the Conservatives, but not very much. For various other reasons, for technical reasons, Labour begin with a considerable advantage at the next election because of boundary revisions that, in general, suit Labour rather than the Conservatives. Miliband Miliband hasn't sealed the deal in terms of being a prime minister in waiting. There are still a lot of people, I think, who look at him and just can't quite picture him as prime minister. And that, in many ways, is his biggest hurdle. It is, of course, true that if the economy picks up this year and next, then Conservative chances of returning to power are greatly increased. I think as for the impact of this vote, I think it's one of those things that the Westminster Village over places too much importance upon. I think most people in the country will have forgotten about this in a month's time. It matters to the extent that people perceive Cameron to be weaker and then write about him as though he's weaker. But how much that trickles down to the general public, I don't know. I mean, there are questions for Miliband as well. At least people know more or less what Cameron actually believes in and what he thinks needs to be done in Syria. Miliband does not. I mean, it's not utter mystery what Labour's position is and what Miliband thinks is the right, wisest course of action. So from that point of view, Cameron has shown leadership and Miliband hasn't. So although Miliband's lack of leadership has accidentally put him in the same position as the, you know, put him in the same box as the public is in. Cameron may get more credit for it, even though he's advocated a course of action that the public disapproves of. Mm. You know, it's there's sort of ironies and contradictions abound in these things. I would be surprised, however, if it ends up really being Cameron's downfall, because, you know, it is in the end foreign policy, and elections are not won or lost, at least not in Britain, on foreign policy issues.
Great. Well, thank you. That was helpful. You helped help understand news of last week.
I think it's, you know, a sort of shambles, really, because. You know, there are a lot of people who think, well, actually, maybe Britain should have a policy on Syria. You know, it would be good to have the right policy, but having a policy is better than having no policy. And at the moment, Britain is now in a situation where it doesn't actually have a policy. You know, there are quite a lot of people in Westminster who are beginning to wonder, you know, what the hell did we do last week?
Even if you look at Obama, I mean, bombing Syria to punish them for the use of chemical weapons is not a policy. You know, it's a punishment. It's a symbolic strike, but mm-hmm. it's not a Syria policy. It doesn't sort of get us any closer to a political solution. It doesn't engage the region in any different way. It just is a singular one-off, at least the way that they're framing it, a one-off punishment for the use of chemical weapons.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not a policy.
Yeah, and the difficulty, I suppose, as well, isn't it, is that once you intervene once, you know, once the first plane is taken off, you are mm-hmm. then somehow, you know, you are involved in the conflict. You cannot just sort of wash your hands of it from that point forward, and sort mm-hmm. of say, you know, well, we've sent our message. You guys can get back to slaughtering one another now, and it doesn't really matter what you do because we're not going to get involved again. I don't think it works like that. I think
once you've dipped, slippery slope.
Yeah, exactly. Once you've dipped a toe in the water and so on, it stays wet. You know, and I think that's you know the difficulty with. Or one of the difficulties with what Obama seems to be proposing.
And during the congressional hearings yesterday, there was just one sort of Tea Party member of the Senate and one sort of liberal senator who were raising these sort of slippery slope questions about, you know, what happens next. Mm. No one else seemed to be raising that question, which to me is ultimately the most critical question you can ask is sort of, you know, what comes next? What if this doesn't fail?
Yeah. I mean, policy is so often... question as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, because policy is so often developed on this sort of best case scenario assumptions and planning, and it doesn't always work out that way.
I mean, very rarely. Was it no government action survives contact with reality? You know,
right,
so to speak. I mean, in this sense, you know, Iraq, I think, does have something to tell us about Syria, because we you know, saw what happens. Iraq demonstrated what can go wrong when you don't have a plan, when you haven't actually asked those questions of what happens next, what do we do then? Mm-hmm. Although, you know, the Iraq intervention was obviously on a much greater scale than anything that's being proposed for Syria, it does seem quite extraordinary that you could have this discussion in Congress without somebody asking, you know, what are we actually going to do next? You know, it doesn't require a George Kennan type figure to ask that question.
It's not being asked.
Democracy, yeah. Ain't it great?
Yeah, great. Well, thank you. Thank you, Alex.
Well, thank you, Mark. Yeah, we'll see how it plays out, I guess, won't we?
Yeah. I mean, I have no... I really couldn't tell who's going to... How this vote is going to play out in Congress.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
Yeah.
Great.
Okay, splendid.